Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for what I hope will be a fascinating and interesting discussion around some of the latest data in rheumatology. My name is Professor Peter Nash from Griffith University in beautiful downtown Brisbane. And today we're very fortunate to have a very busy man, one of the few original thinkers in rheumatology. I'm delighted to be joined by Professor Dennis McGonigal, clinical professor at the University of Leeds School of Medicine. And we're going to be talking about a recently published paper in the British Society of Rheumatology journal Rheumatology in February. And it's talking about the association of clinical components of distal and the phalangeal joint synovial complex and the subsequent response to either the IL-17A inhibitor ixekizumab or the TNF inhibitor adalimumab in PSA. So this is talking about a post-hoc analysis from the SPIRIT head-to-head study. Dennis, just to introduce yourself, could you tell the audience a little bit about yourself and your journey and maybe what your special interests are at the moment and what you're working on at the moment?
Hi, Peter. Yeah, hello, everyone. Yeah, as you say, nice to see you again after meeting you, what, 2 weeks ago in Brisbane, which is too late to do this recording because we had a big dinner and we felt a bit.
Under the weather.
That's a nice way of putting it. Yeah. Yeah. So I work in Leeds, where Werner Reich described the modern concept of psoriatic arthritis in 1956, and 90% of people. In his paper in the Annals, 90% of PSA cases had nail disease, and we have a big interest in the pathogenesis of psoriatic arthritis from diagnosis to imaging to therapy and understanding mechanisms. And one of the things is that we described how the nail is anchored directly to the distal DIP extensor tendon. And that we showed that was also linked to remote enthesopathy in the lower limbs. So people with nail disease without arthritis have enthesopathy in the lower limbs. So Zoe Ash published a paper on this in Annals about a decade ago. And then with Sybil Aden here, working here in Leeds, we showed that nail psoriasis is linked to ultrasound enthesopathy in the tendon in people without clinical arthritis. So given that the nail predicts psoriatic arthritis in people with psoriasis, the nail's a bit of a key that unlocks the understanding of immunopathogenesis.
And what about the enthesitis? Why is enthesopathy so important, Dennis?
Well, there's literally thousands of entheses around the body holding us together, many of them quite small. So given that the enthesis is at the crossroads of the joint, the bone, and the extracapsular tissue, it nicely explains the apparently heterogeneous peripheral and axial pathology that's characteristic of PSA, including synovitis, enthesitis, pericapsular edema because of inflammation spreading out from the capsule, and then osteitis and diffuse lesions, including DIP, diffuse osteitis, which appears to be a forerunner of arthritis mutilins, typically occurring in the distal phalanx and a feature of PSA underneath where the nail is, and not a feature of RA. So at every level, the nail is this sort of bridge between the skeleton and the skin, where there's literally nail anchorage to the skeleton, so we can hang on by our fingernails, etc. Climbing walls, not something I do, but mountaineers do things like this.
And do you hold to the sort of Georg Schett type hypothesis that it's skin first, enthesitis second, synovitis and damage third? Do you think that's a bit simplistic, or do you think that's reasonably accurate as to how we should think of the progress of PSA over time?
Oh, well, that was our original 1998 Lancet paper claiming that unlike RA, which starts with synovitis in the joints, that the psoriatic phenotype in the joints started with enthesopathy, then enthesitis and synovitis. But of course, that simple psoriasis and disease coming from the skin to the enthesis to the synovium, that's a bit too simplistic in the sense that children with PSA typically develop the arthritis and then the psoriasis years later. And of course, psoriatic arthritis in adults, 10% have the arthropathy before the discernible psoriasis. So the enthesis either way is the key, probably the key lesion in the vast majority of cases with skeletal pathology.
And I have this ongoing argument with Helena Ortega about don't, if you can't find swelling in a normal CSR and they've got lots of aches and pains, don't just write them off as fibromyalgia. They might well have a lot of active enthesopathy. Do you think that's real or not real?
I mean, there is some imaging data from Italy looking at fibromyalgia and psoriatic patient with joint pains. And there is a greater burden of subclinical enthesopathy in the psoriasis route compared to fibromyalgia. The problem, Peter, is how do you tell the two apart? Because as you say, the relatively avascular nature of enthesis precludes the systemic response in the early phases that you see in rheumatoid or other more systemic inflammatory diseases. So it's a difficult one to address. And also, it's important to realize that people who have chronic inflammatory pain that they're told they have fibromyalgia, they will eventually develop a chronic widespread post-inflammatory pain syndrome that is fibromyalgia that's superimposed on top. So yeah, it's a tricky one.
It is. And lastly, imaging. Everyone's pushing ultrasound as a way of diagnosing these patients. And yet, when you look hard at the papers, Doppler, power Doppler or not, ultrasound, MRI, they've got no symptoms where it lights up. And sometimes they've got terrible symptoms where it doesn't light up. So, what are we to make of imaging of enthesopathy?
Yeah, so just to contextualize that, early rheumatoid is typically a synovitis. You do an ultrasound, you can biopsy it, show the vascularization that correlates to power Doppler and immune cell infiltrate, and biopsy after and show resolution and show it on ultrasound. All gold standard stuff. But enthesial-centric pathologies, as you say, there's often subclinical enthesial abnormalities with or without power Doppler. And then there are many subjects who have the inflammatory symptoms that respond to therapy that do not show so much on ultrasound of the joint. And this is down to the relatively avascular nature, but good innervation of enthesial structures. So we do not have a gold standard test yet. And whether molecular imaging or novel PET scan tracers will literally light up the enthesial pathologies is still a research question. So yeah, clinical acumen is important and ultimately a trial of therapy if in doubt.
Yeah, very tricky. But let's talk about your paper. This is a post-hoc analysis, a very important paper, Spirit head-to-head, only the second ever head-to-head 17 against a TNF in psoriatic arthritis studies. Very important paper. Post-hoc's fair enough. You might want to just mention a little bit about this particular study, if you wouldn't mind, for the audience who can't to refresh their memories.
Yeah, so Peter, this is your study, obviously. So seminal paper, the Spirit head-to-head, looking at ixekizumab versus adalimumab in active psoriatic arthritis subjects. And the key aspect of this study was that methotrexate was allowed in both arms, if I'm not mistaken, unlike the EXCEED study, where secukinumab went head-to-head with adalimumab. And this study had the composite PASI 100 ACR50 composite outcome. And ixekizumab was superior to adalimumab in the study. But when you looked, when you, when I say you, I mean Peter Nash et al. Looked at the ACR 20, 50, and 70, it was basically neck and neck between ixekizumab and adalimumab, and the difference was really down to the superior efficacy in the skin. And that sets a scene nicely for this particular paper where we looked at the DIP joint, including DIP tenderness and or swelling. So many of the people in this analysis had DIP joint tenderness without swelling. And when you realize that the entheses around the DIP extend from the joint and anchor into the nail matrix and the lateral nail, tenderness around the DIP to the metrologists may be actually originating from the nail. So this is this elaborate synovioenthesial complex integrating the DIP joint with the terminal phalanx with the nail itself. So although the nail is avascular and aneural, the anchorage tissue of the nail are very rich in nerve endings. And because of this integration of the nail both to the skin and joint, tenderness originating in this region may actually not be merely joint, but it could be due to the complex integration between the nail and the skin and the joint. So this is what makes this
Yeah,
study
and
curious.
practically, we clinicians have great trouble treating DIP disease. It's very difficult sometimes, very painful, large, swollen. I've always had trouble in people with nodal OA who happen to have psoriasis, but very symptomatic joints. How much is PSA? How much is just coincidental? It can be quite tricky. So the DIP, I've always said if the nail's involved, then it's more likely to be PSA. And we look for evidence in places where OA doesn't go for synovitis, bone marrow edema, tenosynovitis. And the other thing was the 17s were trying to say that they were more effective at enthesitis than TNFs, but hadn't been studied before you did this analysis. And they were even doing trials enriched for enthesitis to try and show the difference. So it's a very important question to ask. Just to remind, SPIRIT head-to-head, as you've suggested, open label, but they allowed background methotrexate, which was important. They were BDMARD naive before they started, and they had to have skin disease as well as joint disease. And the primary endpoint was superiority, which was a big thing to ask at 24 weeks. And they got criticized because of that combination primary endpoint. But when you think about it, for most PSA patients, the skin is vitally important, just as important as the joint. So I think it's not unreasonable to look at both, Dennis.
No, absolutely. And this study did that. And what was interested in the finger units where they looked both at nail disease using an APSI and then looking at DIP tenderness and/or swelling. And I'm just reading the numbers of the total number of patients getting into the study of 566. 65% of these had actually DIP tenderness or swelling versus 199 without DIP joint involvement. So almost two-thirds of these people in this study had DIP disease, which is actually, Peter, I'd say pretty high, isn't it?
Pretty
As a
common.
patient.
Yes, it is very, most studies sort of have half the patients have enthesitis and about a third dactylitis. Can you, I tried to find a few, the numbers, and they're really quite small, who had the DIP tenderness plus or minus swelling, but no nail involvement. Do you still
Yeah, that,
think that
yeah,
that's
absolutely.
a number, but an interesting group?
Yeah, well, this is an interesting study in that regard because the vast majority of people who had tenderness or swelling also had nail psoriasis, which is over 95%. Now, historically, in other papers in the literature, when dermatologists look at psoriasis, about 50% of cases with nail psoriasis, Phoebe Rich's work, were reported to have periungual tenderness. So this was quite high. And then looking at it the other way, in this study again, patients with DIP tenderness, the vast majority of those also happened to have nail psoriasis. So this study is a bit of an outlier in that regard, in that the vast majority of people with nail disease had concomitant tenderness or swelling. And then those with DIP tenderness or swelling, the vast majority of those as well, likewise, had nail psoriasis. So this was an unusually strong association. And I just wonder, at the planning phase of the study, was there a strong emphasis put on metrology of the DIP joint? And where do you press? Because if you press over the joint proper, it's slightly different from using two fingers and pressing over the joint and the nail matrix. You may elicit, well, the point of making this tenderness elicited around the DIP, feeling with four fingers, two above and two below. That tenderness and feeling in front of the patient, that tenderness and pressure, you're actually exerting not just over the joint, but over the nail matrix region and the lateral anchorage of the ligamentous and tendinous tissue to the nail.
I think that it was enriched because they insisted on more than 3% body surface skin. And as you've said time and time again, skin and nails go together. So maybe that's helped some of the reason. So tell us a little bit about the results comparing TNF adalimumab, which many argue that plus methotrexate is the gold standard, versus IL-17A inhibition with ixekizumab.
Yeah, so just to put in context, in the dermatology literature prior to this, in trials in psoriasis with secukinumab, ixekizumab, and guselkumab, for example, there seems to be more improvement in nails compared to TNF blockers because the dermatologists have done head-to-head. So that's a general statement. I think you'd agree with you. You often see, in line with the skin improving, and the nail being a skin appendage in one sense, you typically see improvements in nail psoriasis that are numerically greater under IL-23/17 pathway inhibitors compared to TNF blockers. So that's in psoriasis. Now, in this study, if I just get the, if I just get the, I can't see it in front of me. You may have to edit this out as I fumble around. In this study, there was numerically greater improvements in nail psoriasis. To me, that would be expected under ixekizumab compared to adalimumab. And I am just looking at the numbers at 24 weeks. There was a statistically, nominally significantly greater resolution of nail psoriasis. So we're talking pure skin here, of ixekizumab over adalimumab. And by week 52, the difference had narrowed to resolution of nail psoriasis and 85% of ixekizumab versus 80% of adalimumab-treated patients. And I would say that's in keeping with the literature. Now, DIP joint swelling would speak to a psoriatic arthritis, simplistically put, if the joint is swollen. And resolution of DIP swelling was significantly greater at week 24 and at week 52. With ixekizumab compared to adalimumab. Now, if you cast your mind back to the primary or the analysis of the ACR50s, there was no obvious difference at the patient level, but here at the DIP level, there is this 5% difference in resolution of swelling. So that's a difference from the other joints around the skeleton, Peter, where the ACR 20, 50, and 70 were identical in the primary analysis that you published in The Lancet a few years ago. So there is this numerical difference here. I put resolution of some of this swelling, I believe, is actually maybe due to periungual inflammation, because the inflammation in these synovial endothelial complexes goes extracapsular and it extends outside the synovial component. So I think that may be a reason for the slight difference in favor of ixekizumab and the DIP, but not other joints. Now, if what I'm saying is unclear, that to me the most striking aspect of this study was when you broke down the three aspects: resolution of nail psoriasis, resolution of DIP swelling, What about tenderness? That was the third thing looked at. And at week 52, 89% of the ICSI treated patients, but only 78%, an 11% delta, 78% of the adalimumab treated patients had resolution of DIP tenderness. Now, that's out of kilter to the rest of the study, isn't it, Peter, where the ACR responses were identical using the ACR 20. But when you did this bespoke evaluation of the DIP, you see substantially more resolution of tenderness. So I think this is really important because it supports the anatomical, microanatomical knowledge we have of how the DIP joint is functionally integrated with the nail matrix and periungual tissues, which are all well innervated. So I think this 11% delta between ixekizumab and adalimumab reflects the fact that some of the nail symptoms and loss of function and loss of dexterity and difficulty that people with DIP involvement face, it comes down to the fact that the IL-17 pathway blockade is having this impact on the skin side or the skin appendage component that is functionally integrated to the skeleton. So I found that really fascinating when Lily first shared with us, the data set. And then the final part of this is when complete resolution of tenderness, swelling, and psoriasis was looked at, it was numerically superior, statistically so, at week 12, right through to week 52, with a 65% resolution of everything in ICSI versus 58% on adalimumab. So this benefit with ixekizumab over adalimumab in this very important joint was seen by combining all the elements. So I think that was very, very interesting to me, this analysis, and it really affirms the functional integration.
I think rheumatologists always underestimate the impact bad nails have on the patient, and this pain and tenderness and the irritation for people with bad nails and bad DIP, it's a very difficult problem if you talk to your patients about it, and we always underestimate it. And I went back to the original paper, and the SPARC and the LEIs, they both consistent with this numerical difference of the 10 to 12% in favor of the 17 inhibitor at 24 weeks compared to the TNF. So I think that's pretty important. Do you think it's possible that we could then look further at studies where those patients with nails but no arthritis, if you treat with one compared to the other, you can prevent the development of PSA? I mean, that's underway, but what's your feeling about it, Dennis?
Yeah, so that's needs teasing out a bit, doesn't it? There's that paper from Sina et al. In Lancet Rheumatology at the beginning of 2023, where the best drug for ostensibly preventing PSA was the IL-23 blockers, then the p40 IL-12/23 blockers, then IL-17, then TNF. So IL-17 blockers in that electronic medical database didn't look so good, but a couple of comments is there are lots of potential biases there, including the selection of people with arthralgia or possible psoriatic arthritis who are not seen by a rheumatologist, and they're either treated with a TNF or IL-17 blocker, because as your study and Ian's EXCEED study, et cetera, with Novartis, show numerical superiority of 17 blockers over TNF blockers or equivalents. So there may be a mindset that, oh, if we think somebody may have low-grade arthritis, let's give a TNF or a 17 blocker. So maybe that's why in these prevention, these observational studies, that 17 blockers were not as good allegedly at preventing arthritis. And here we have this data that we're now discussing, which says if anything, a 17 blocker might be superior because, as you say, the nail is an enthocele structure. It is an odds ratio of three or thereabouts, the same odds ratio as the shared epitope in rheumatoid. As a risk for rheumatoid, the shared epitope is an odds ratio of three or four, as the nail is an odds ratio of three or four to get PSA, and the nail's an enthocele structure. And here it is responding beautifully or better numerically than a TNF blocker. And as you rightly point out, in the SPIRT head-to-head, the SPARC index was statistically significant at week 24 for the polyenthocele sites. And then the Leeds index wasn't statistically significant, but numerically superior. So yes, this, Peter, is one of those conundrums that we're now looking at, is this data we're discussing would suggest that IL-17 blockers, by virtue of the nail enthocele apparatus, might be a good way to prevent arthritis. All I can say is, as a working in a joint dermatology rheumatology service, I rarely see people on biologics turning up with new onset PSA, and if they do, the phenotype is often modified for less severe disease. So it's not my experience in our center, but 17
So,
blockers are inferior.
we'll ask you for your take-home messages shortly, but I always think that SPIRT head-to-head taught us a couple of other things. The TNF arm had twice the dropouts for adverse effects discontinuation. And you had to have methotrexate with it because they got a 10% improvement in ACR responses, and they had three times as many serious adverse events. So, all treatment algorithms are very interesting, but given the safety of these drugs, the 17s and the 23s, and your data now with this most difficult area to treat, I wonder if the 17s should come before TNFs, unless the cheapness of biosimilars drives that decision. What's happening in your clinic and in your neck of the woods as far as algorithms are concerned? Is it driven by the trust says you must do this, or NICE says you must do this?
Yeah, so in the UK, in England, we have these strategic health authorities, and I think there's at least four of them, and they negotiate effectively as the size of a European, small European democracy. And our negotiations, we don't know the prices, but biosimilar anti-TNF is cheaper than injectable methotrexate in Yorkshire. And that is a huge impact in driving the selection of therapy. Unless the patient is young with severe psoriasis, where we lean on our dermatology colleagues to go straight in, as you say, with the 17 blocker. But as you say, this is very important, the retention and safety, if we want to treat and prevent the later evolution of psoriatic arthritis. Very important factor.
So thank you so much for your time, Dennis. Any take-home message for the clinician from this particular analysis? And you can get the paper, everybody, and have a look at the graph. It's very interesting. They separate at the very first time point, and they continue to be separated. Take-home message, please, for the clinician about this particular tricky DIP nail joint domain of PSA.
Yeah, so the take-home message here is this DIP complex is behaving different in terms of the arthritis when ixekizumab is compared to adalimumab, with numerical superiority in all of these features in the DIP, which wasn't evident in other joints, other synovial joints, the swollen joint count 66, the ACR responses were the same when it averaged out. But there is something unique about the DIP, which we knew, I suppose, to some degree. But this all goes down to the impairment patients are experiencing is linked to the functional impairment, not just from the joint cavity where the articular cartilage is, but from the wider enthocele network permeation, penetration into the adjacent lateral aspects of the nail anchorage site. And this translates into meaningful differences in the two drugs, as you say, with separation at all time points, and particularly the tenderness being quite striking. And I think this is relevant if you have, well, for example, clearly relevant if you've got a patient who's a neurosurgeon or a watchmaker, and also relevant if they're a beautician who uses their hands and you know that their hands are their public face in the beauty industry. But it's relevant in more than those three professions. I think it's on the radar now.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. If you'd like to know more about this paper and others uploaded to the Immune-Mediated Inflammatory Disease Forum website, you can get detailed slide sets available in the publication section at imidforum.com. Please subscribe to this podcast on Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast media. Let us know what you think. You can also watch this on YouTube. And follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and Facebook to keep up with all the new inflammatory disease content coming soon in 2024. Dennis, we greatly appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Cheers.
Bye, everyone.